Hey, good morning, good afternoon, everybody. It's great to see you for our May members meeting. Feel free to stay on screen if you'd like. You can be off screen, whatever's most comfortable to you on this Friday. I'm Scott Kirschner, CEO and co-founder of InnoLead, hosting this meeting with my colleague, Alex Slosby, our Chief Growth Officer. I think we're going to have a really good group of participants today. And I wanted to let you know just like a little bit about our plan. First of all, we have a couple questions that we want to cover with our invited guests, but we always love it if the chat is super active. So get that started, like introduce yourself in the chat, name, where you're at, and maybe what your connection is. Are you on the corporate side as a user of consulting? Are you on the provider side? I definitely see some friendly faces out there. Mara, it was good to see you in person in Sunnyvale, California, a couple weeks ago. Gene O'Connor, good to see you. Steven Shapiro, Evelyn, Dolly, so great to see some friendly IL community faces out there today. So use the chat, just introduce us geographically, where are you at? How do you connect to this topic around the future of consulting? And let me introduce, we have a couple folks, and Alex, maybe you can help me kind of spotlight speakers as we introduce them. We've got John Edson with us today. He's a partner at Lunar Design, which was acquired by McKinsey. He was then a senior advisor to PA Consulting, now is principal of John X Design, his own firm. We've got Dan Ostrower with us. Dan was CEO of Altitude when we first connected. Altitude was here in the Boston area, 45-person design and innovation consultancy. They were acquired by Accenture, and Dan went on to lead Accenture's product innovation business through 2018. He's now founder of Third Horizon, an advisory firm focused on human-centric strategy, experience, design, and product innovation. And finally, we've got Abby Godey. She is the European lead for innovation. She has been the European lead for innovation strategy at Frog Design. She's been a vice president and a chief design officer at Philips, a partner at Deloitte Digital, and now chief experience officer at Publicis Sapient, a firm that focuses on digital business transformations. With all of that out of the way, maybe Abby, I should first start with you because you have the most interesting title, and tell us, how is the role of chief experience officer defined at a digital transformation consultancy?
That's funny. It is an interesting title. I remember when Fast Company, like 20 years ago, did an article on like the most interesting titles. They were actually more interesting back then. Chief Experience Officer is really trying to look at the full end-to-end experience. And the problem with the word experience is it's been co-opted by a lot of different folks from different corners of our industry. And to a lot of people, when they start talking about experience, they just mean the technology. And what we mean is everything that the user perceives and understands to be a component of the thing that they're exchanging value for. So it includes a lot of design, but it also includes strategy and content and research and a bunch of other sort of specialized skill sets that we believe are necessary to look at it end to end.
And how big is the firm globally?
Sapient is actually started in Boston, by the way, so 30 years ago. And through its various different incarnations, it's grown to be a 20,000 person consulting organization across, something like 20 different countries. And my team is about 1,300 experienced folks.
All right, love it. Yes, I remember the days when every internet development firm had to end with an ENT or ANT. There was Sapient, there was Viant, there was Cyient, and there were probably a couple others that I no longer remember. So John and Dan, are you guys kind of in the sole proprietor phase? Is that an accurate way to describe what you're doing these days?
I prefer to think of it as entrepreneur. And I actually, John by design is my consulting shingle, but I've got a couple of other things that I'm trying to, being in Silicon Valley, have been around for so long, but I'm trying to start up a couple of other things, one in education and one is product based.
Definitely in that phase, Scott. I mean, in my consulting career, I've seen a bunch of different environments. I was at monitor company, which was kind of like a McKinsey-esque strategy firm. I was at Altitude, which is a 40-50 person boutique design and innovation. And then I was at Accenture. So I've kind of seen all those different manifestations, and sole proprietor is one of the ones that I think is on the upswing, let's say.
So there was a really interesting announcement yesterday from PwC earlier this week. I think it may have been late Wednesday that they're going to become the largest enterprise user of ChatGPT. They're going to be a reseller of ChatGPT. Like ChatGPT is a, you know, is a big part of the future for PwC. I guess I wonder, like, maybe to start off with, you know, AI and consulting, I think people are trying to figure out, okay, is this a tool in the toolbox? Is this something much bigger where it becomes the whole toolbox, or potentially clients view it as something that is a replacement for things that they used to buy from consultancies? Like, I'd be curious to start, where do the three of you land on that? Dan, do you want to start first?
Yeah, I'm happy to. And I think, you know, the answer to that question is probably going to change over time. The way I think about answering that question is, I start with, well, what is consulting, right? And so my model for it, and I'll try to be quick, but people hire consultants because at the end of the day, they want some form of change. They want more revenue, or they want a new product, or they want a new software installed, or whatever it is. And I think there's kind of three C's behind that change, right? One is clarity, right? So the consultant can help bring clarity. What is the business we should launch? What should the product look like? The other is capability, right? So training, or actually helping people do stuff. And then third is conviction, right? The organizational will to make the change. So all three of those are needed. And the first, and by the way, I would say, like, if you're hiring a consultant, have that change model in mind and know which of those you want from your consultant and what mix. But consultants help on all three of those different levels. And so I would say, I think what's happening right now is AI is really in the clarity space, right? It's helping bring the answer, right? What should the new thing be? And it's helping doing that faster, bringing in different perspectives, but it's not doing it totally alone yet. I think it will continue to chip away at that space, and consultants will end up being more of a guide in the clarity space over time. But I think it's going to be slower for AI to chip away at capability and conviction, especially. Conviction is really human behavior and human psychology oriented. It's not to say that it won't, but I think we're going to see a progression through that over time.
Abby, how would you characterize where we are right now? What kind of what sort of transition slope is happening, and where are we on that slope?
Well, I agree with what Dan said, except I think for us, because we are also very technology rich at Sapient. So we are seeing an intense demand just over the last year for AI-driven solutions. Some mostly in the short term, based around optimization, cost reduction, streamlining of things. We're doing some amazing stuff in that space, which is saving, you know, thousands of hours and costs. That's great. But we're also seeing a really increasing demand for rethinking modes of consumer and user interaction across all digital touch points. And the way I think about it is that, you know, we're facing the biggest disruption for experience in the last 30 years, you know, after the internet and then mobile. Those were really quite small and trivial compared to what we're going to be facing now. We spent the last 40 years trying to figure out how humans could work with computers on their terms. And now it's flipped. You know, they can actually work with us on our terms, but we have to do it. You know, we're really trying to help companies navigate what that means and what those new paradigms should be.
I guess one quick follow-up for you, just because I think when we talk to large companies, a lot of what we're seeing now is like, they literally still need the workshop that is like, here's the landscape of tools that are out there. Here's the landscape of possibilities. Often they are kind of in the policy freeze phase, right, of like where the CIO or someone at the C-level has said, like, don't be using these, you know, sort of generative AI consumer facing tools as part of your work. Is that kind of similar, you know, as opposed to saying like, hey, we've got 20 projects and we're moving headlong forward. Is that a lot of what you're seeing too? Or do you think more companies really have projects in flight right now?
I think there's definitely a clear kind of increased sort of regulatory perspective on the tools, right? Because there is a Wild West proliferation of tools out there. But you have to also separate AI from generative AI. And so we're seeing a huge demand right now for AI, quite a bit of demand for generative AI and agent-driven experiences to be able to help streamline the way we do work, the way we show up. So we're not seeing any kind of lockdown in that. And we're shocked actually now, a year after we started a lot of our bigger investments, we're shocked is maybe not the right word, but we are really, really surprised to see how far along some of our clients are. And what's interesting, I think we're going to get into this moment in the next, you know, few months where a lot of the clients start to enter that valley of despair, where they see that a lot of the investments they're making aren't necessarily producing the results they hoped for and expected. And so I think there's going to be another rationalization on top of that.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. I feel like a lot of the tech, you know, the Silicon Valley tech platforms have been earlier, right, to hit those speed bumps. And I don't think they're in the valley of despair yet where they're pulling back. They're continuing to invest. But it's really an interesting and important point that, like, failures will happen, bad PR will happen, you know, speed bumps will happen with some of these deployments, whether generative or otherwise. John, how about you? Like, where are we on this journey and kind of what are you seeing as you interact with large companies?
Well, so to be perfectly honest, I've been out of McKinsey for a number of years and I've been out of PA for two. And so I haven't been interacting with big companies of late, but I have seen, you know, if I look over the course of my career, it's been really interesting to see these kinds of, you know, disruptions happen, especially in my space, in design and innovation, where, you know, if you look back in the 80s and the Mac came out and desktop publishing was going to obliterate graphic design, right? We said, everything's going to be gone. But we, you know, what we did was we leveled up and we moved to the next level of abstraction. And it turned out that what happened with desktop publishing, it just made everybody aware of design, right? Along with Apple itself, of course, bringing everybody into that awareness that design is important for business. And I think I could talk a lot about, you know, having sold my firm to McKinsey and Company and been a partner there for 4 years and seen what's happened in recent days and recently compared notes with Tim Brown. I think we've moved through another era where design has been operationalized. And it's interesting to me that kind of happened before. It's very hard to sell big transformation. I don't know what your experience is, Abby, but it was very hard to start selling, you know, continue selling big design transformation kinds of projects. But we've moved kind of past that, and then AI has shown up. And I think I agree with what Dan and Abby have said in terms of that. I know you asked about big companies, but we're seeing, I think there's going to be an absorption period for sure, right? And we're going to retool around this this really big disruption. But my view is that we're going to figure out how to make this a tool. We were talking before we started about, and I saw Pearl Jam last Saturday for the first time ever. I've always known their music, but I've never seen them live. And it was, I was crying. Eddie Vedder is an amazing performer. And that's something that's never, you know, we're going to see really beautiful things come out of AI, both from the business, you know, we generate new business and new opportunities out of it, but also from a creative aspect, we're going to see lots of stuff come out of it. And maybe some of that stuff will make us cry, but I think this, I see it as a really evolved tool that's going to help, we're going to stand on the shoulders of and become really powerful with.
Well, let's say more about Eddie Vedder. And if Abby and Dan, and if others in the room have thoughts on Eddie Vedder. But I do think it's an interesting point, right? Which is like when you are a kind of artist personality, known brand, that feels like it's a pretty good place to be as we enter this AI era, right? Where people are like, I need Dan to keynote my, you know, company innovation day. as opposed to I just need someone who knows about innovation and design to show up. Like, I do think that being in that, you know, you're a known personality with ideas that people trust, and you know, you can kind of sell them on the change that needs to happen or sell them on the idea that needs to be executed. That feels like a great place to be right now. And I just worry that, well, 98% of all of us knowledge workers are not in that Eddie Vedder strata. So I don't know if you have thoughts on that.
I mean, I think coming back a little bit to what I was saying before, I think obviously consulting is a huge space with lots of things in it, but I think one of the things that we'll see is maybe a move towards a more advisorship type model, right? Like if the work is more of it is being done by AI, right? Then, well, now we can focus on the meaning of the work for the people in the organization, for the organization itself, how the organization actually makes change, what it takes to motivate people, right? Which is all necessary for change to happen. And that is a big part of consulting. And I think we'll see perhaps more of an effort place there and perhaps a perfection of the skills. Because what I would say is that I think that's still an evolving art space, right? And I don't know that the advisor is exactly the same as Eddie Vedder in terms of the brand name, but the relationship and the trust are what may distinguish people in that space. Then, hey, I'm going to go and choose a consultant based on their process or based on the tools that they use, right?
Yeah, I'd say the advisory, what I'm seeing more and more is advisory and the demand for proof are collapsing into one another. And so advisory without proof is becoming less valuable. And the building and the crafting of the unique solutions without creativity is becoming less valuable. So I think the things that are going to have the premium as we evolve the world of consulting and also in industry is advisory with more substantiated proof that's brought through, you know, data and AI, as well as the creative application to configuration and orchestration of experiences and less reliance on the individual manipulation of every artifact.
And say what you mean, say more about what you mean about proof. Like, so saying, here is the data set that validates this strategy. That would be an example of proof. And Maybe you can query that data set because it's, you know, it's got a chat interface to it potentially.
I think in a very, very literal sense, yes, that could be it. But what I'm referring to is advisory with data that creates evidence of real success in the market and demonstrates path to, you know, increased customer demand and increased utilization and increased application as part of that advisory offering is going to be increasingly important. I mean, most clients, like the ideas, you know, we've gone through this whole, like, however many years of, you know, people buying innovation process and incubators and, you know, startup boot camps and everything else. But the thing that all the clients struggle with is scaling those ideas. I mean, there's problems with the ideas themselves, but it's mostly around scaling something that seemed like a great idea and there seems to be demand. But how do you create that path to increased value? What's so interesting to me, and I promise I will be quiet and not digress too much, but after 25 years working in mostly product development and innovation space, I'm now in a company that's owned by Publicis Group, which has been fascinating to me because I never worked in the area of advertising, media, and marketing before in that way. And now I understand the kind of existential problem our clients are facing in a very different way than I did before. And it's given me a different perspective of what does proof look like? It's not just a data set to say it's a good idea, but it's demonstrated traction in the market with clear path to scale. And that's the kind of proof I'm talking about. And you have to collapse those cycles to be able to get at that faster and in a more meaningful way.
All right. Paul Campbell says as a joke in the chat, consulting firms need to hire consulting firms to figure out what to do next. But I wonder, you know, like, is there... what are you guys seeing when you look around the consulting landscape, you know, largely at medium, large, you know, brand name consulting firms. I mean, is there a real existential threat to them, or do you feel like, okay, this is a technology absorption point where the ways they work are going to change, but there isn't really anything that, you know, that feels like the brick wall that they're racing towards?
I think the way of work is going to change. How relevant it is, but McKinsey bought a firm called Quantum Black, maybe circa 2017-18, and they were a really beautiful data analytics firm, and had design embedded, so they would produce things that were really easy to query and understand, and that made the information really relevant. They've of course repositioned that firm as an AI part of the business, but it was really explosive to put those two things together, to put advisory and, I think to your point, Abby, proof together. That firm is unlike my firm, which all the design acquisitions were rebranded McKinsey Design. Quantum Black is one of the few acquisitions that is Quantum Black by McKinsey, because they have exploded. I think they were, my last data point was in 2022, and they were 10x the size that they were when they were acquired, because it's such an important, that proof was really, really important, and putting that together in advisory. So I think that's one model, and I think that's where we'll continue to go. I think CEOs are going to want to challenge their teams with, well, you know, you're not a fill in the blank, but you've used AI to fill in that blank. I don't, you know, necessarily trust that. I think there's, you know, there are going to be product managers certainly that are going to be outsourcing their product design and manufacturing to AI. And I think we're going to see some bumps in the road in that. But I think it's still really important. Where is the human in the loop? I think is the question. And I think McKinsey will say, well, we've got really senior smart advisors that are going to help process all this stuff and bring all these inputs together and give really good advice. I think the pricing model, the pricing model for the senior advisors will probably go up, but the generation of the work will go down. And my question is, it really important to the McKinsey model in particular, and I think with other firms as well, is the way that they have worked for 100 years is we've got really smart people at the top. We bring in smart people who are having no experience at the bottom, and we've got this process to kind of grind you through all of these, nights and weekends of looking for data. I don't know if those people will learn faster now and become partners in 3 years instead of seven. But I think that there'll be some compression in that, and the compression in the pricing model, the bottom. Yeah.
Dan, I'd love for you to jump in and, like, you know, almost maybe play out the scenario of, like, if we put you back in Accenture, we put you at BCG as the CEO, like, what would be the level of urgency and what would you be trying to do at the moment?
I mean, I think the urgency is high. I mean, I see AI as, we have new technologies all the time. AI has a very, very high potential disruption factor. Like any technology, it's going to go through the hype cycle and the technology adoption curve. So it'll be slower than we think, but the end result is more disruptive than virtually almost anything. And that, I think that that's true of consulting as well. At the same time, though, I think of it as a real opportunity for consultants. And by the way, I do about half of my work, follow on the joke, consulting to consulting companies, typically the smaller ones, but I do that. I think it's really important to understand, like, one of the driving factors behind running a consulting firm, which is it's a shitty business model. Your working capital is 100% perishable. If you don't sell that hour, it's gone forever and you're never getting it back, right? And at the end of the day, we are selling, even though we want to value price and all those things, we're selling people's time. So the ability to productize services, right, starts to flip that business model and starts to make it a more attractive business model if you can execute it, right? And technology allows you to do that. And AI helps you to do that as well. So I think you're seeing, I mean, I saw at Accenture, like, they were doing acquisitions like crazy. They bought Altitude, which was a professional services firm. It was people, but they're buying technology and they're buying products. And Abby, I think you were referring to this before, like, you're building product, right? And so there's a huge desire in consulting firms to to improve the business model. And while AI is a threat to the core, it's also an opportunity to improve the core. So I think you see the urgency from both sides.
I want to just mention, I shared a link just because this is a fantastic group of people in the room. I would love to see what happens if you start posting some of your, we've had some great responses, some great comments in the chat, but if you want to use this Poll Everywhere board to post some predictions, could be predictions about boutique, small consultancies, medium consultancies, the big guys, how work gets done, what team formation looks like. Post anything there, and you can post more than one thing. And the benefit there versus Zoom chat is we can upvote, you know, what are the most insightful predictions? So again, I'll share that link in the chat so you can go over there. Abby, I wanted to ask you to maybe add some color because you're in the chat talking with Trip and saying, we have to go back here to the thread where you said AI won't be better at creating proof until it has a bank account and it can buy our clients' products and services. So we may be close to that with all of the work being done around agents, right? And kind of these autonomous agents running around the internet doing stuff. But say more about what you mean there.
Well, what I mean very plainly is that everything we do with data is to model a desired outcome and to look at the potential, you know, the potential for that outcome to be realized. And AI can certainly accelerate and improve our ability to do that prediction. But the outcome is, you know, except in the case of healthcare, or private, you know, public sector or some other industries, the healthcare is generally that, or the outcome is generally that you're looking for is for more consumers to pay more money to our clients for their products and services. And so that's the proof. And I think people forget that the data is, you know, increased confidence. It's not proof. It's not proof until it actually has an impact in the market. You know, and so that's what we're really looking for. And I think that we have to look at the full circle. Like, so most of our clients are saying, like, I want personalized experiences. I'm like, do you want personalized experiences or do you want more people paying attention to your brand and spending more time engaged and maybe, you know, higher ARPU or whatever, you know, better, more lifetime value? Like, that's what they want, you know, and personalization may be a way to get there. But, you know, I think we have to keep our eye clearly focused on what is the outcome we're trying to drive. And AI is a huge part of getting us there in a more efficient way. I can talk more later if you want on some of the investments we're making as a company, just to give you a picture of like how seriously we're taking it.
Why don't we do that now? And then I have one other question that I'd like to get to, and then I'd love to throw it out to the group to see where you'd like to take the conversation. But when you say investments, are these largely in creating products that are not as reliant on human consulting hours?
We're changing our complete infrastructure. So it was announced publicly, so I'm not sharing anything, you know, confidential, but at Publicist Group level, our CEO, Artur, hired Sapient and with a few of our key stakeholders across the rest of the group to completely rebuild or to build and rethink the platforms that enable us to do the work we do across insights generation and media and content creation and creative production and software development. And we're investing, I think what Artur, our CEO, said a few months back is it's up to $300 million over the next 3 years to completely rethink the way we do our work, leveraging AI and generative AI. And it's fascinating because it's making us rethink our workforce plan and everything. And of course, our philosophy is that it gives humans superpowers to be able to do this, but it will change the nature of work. It will fundamentally change the way our teams are assembled. And our clients are already asking, by the way, for discounts because they assume that we're already using it and they assume that we're saving money. So they want that pass through, just in a very practical example. It's hilarious.
That's what I was going to ask.
Yeah. They're all asking it. They're like, you're talking so much about all your AI investments. Where's my discount? So I think that's an important thing for us to be able to have clear line of sight on what the value statement is that goes along with these investments so that we are not eroding, you know, our positions even further.
What other trends should we talk about separate from AI that are impacting consulting? I assume there must be some. I'm always very interested in like, well, you know, do clients want to see consultants in the flesh or have a lot of engagements become entirely remote? How are consulting firms bringing in new talent? You know, how are they turning the dials on the amount of new talent or the types of new talent that they bring in? But I'm throwing this maybe to John first, and then whoever wants to jump in next, like trends separate from the use of AI that are impacting consulting.
Well, I just, you know, the one thing that I was, you know, I've been through a couple of consulting firms that were trying to build out a implementation kind of capability using design at the core and actually stand out that way. And I think that trend is gone. That trend is over. I think the great experiment of design, I don't know how you feel, Dan, but the experiment of bringing design into alongside consulting as this super, as another superpower. I think there was a really important era when design creativity was really important for business, right? Stand out by understanding your customers, use this process and this approach, understand your customers better, build products that they want, desire, and you're going to do better in the market. That's why we joined McKinsey, but I think it was the operating models are very different. I also think that we've done a really good job. I was part of authoring a piece at McKinsey called The Business Value of Design. I think we made the case, and it, and to a large degree, I think it's been operationalized by companies that that need it. And we, you know, design thinking and UX design sort of grew at the same time, and I think we made the case, and companies have kind of absorbed it. But I think that, you know, design is a lot of things. One is, you know, creating teams that have empathy. And I think we, you know, even when you talk about business transformation is really hard. And design was used as a lever to do that. And, you know, A.G. Lafley buddied up with IDEO, and he thought it would take 5 years and it took 7, and they kind of got a little bit there. But I think that era is that era is past. I think what we're seeing, you know, in terms of how consulting firms are, you know, what trends there that are there today, I think McKinsey was hiring a bunch of very specific experts, and I think has pulled back a little bit from that because of partially because of these experiments and acquisitions around execution-oriented businesses. And I think going forward, I think there's going to be more need for generalists, I believe, in this era of AI.
I also wonder, I don't want to get back too far into the AI topic. So Dan, go ahead. I'm not going to digress at the moment.
Probably John and I could go on about like design and I'll take it in a different direction. I think there are a couple of other things that are going to affect the way consulting businesses work. As I mentioned before, the big challenge in the consulting business model is labor, right? Like, so it's what drives your product, but it is also what essentially makes the economics of running a consulting business so challenging. All the things that we're seeing happening in the world of the gig economy and that sort of thing, that's coming into play in terms of how consulting firms are run too. So can you put together a really compelling, effective offering and good advisorship without having to hire a bench that now you're compelled to fill, and therefore you have the incentive to sell your client a longer, bigger, more expensive project when they want a shorter, cheaper one, right? So we're seeing different labor models, right? I mean, there's folks like John and I who are independent and don't hire anyone, but there are companies that are putting together teams without hiring those people. You're seeing that more and more. So that's a big one. I also see some changes on like just on the engagement and pricing side of how consultancies are run. There are design shops now that are subscriptions. You pay $5,000 a month and you get design. You never have a meeting with the designer. You just post it to their thing. They turn back the design. So you're seeing things like that where the consultants are working on their business model to make it better in ways that I think are going to drive value for clients as well.
Abby, do you want to jump in on other trends separate from AI? And then I'd love to invite a couple people onto the screen. I know Mara has been thinking a lot about this, and probably Keith, Stephen, Lisa will bring some other people into the conversation.
Sure, I'll make it quick. I think one of the biggest trends we see is that clients are looking for you to tell them what the solution is to their problems, right? And they're looking for the most compelling solution. So we're finding that a lot of our go-to-market and delivery is starting to be organized around solution sets that we see that there's, you know, persistent demand for. And they're all multidisciplinary by nature, but they have a clear kind of pattern associated with them. And, you know, they solve very concrete problems for our clients. And then there's a whole bunch of sort of dusting of advisory around that looks for new value spaces that we can deliver on. But these solutions are becoming more and more the cornerstone of what we do, because they just have this such persistent demand.
All right. I love that. Stephen, can you share? You said you're using Gen AI to replace the need for me. You're a sole proprietor consultant in Florida. What do you mean replace the need for you so you can spend more time doing higher level thinking?
Yeah. So first of all, as background, I come from Accenture. I was there 15 years. I've been on my own for over 20 years now. And you know, it is different, because for me, I'm not looking to grow through headcount. I'm looking to grow through revenues. And to me, the best way to grow through revenues is to find alternate revenue sources that don't require my time. And so before generative AI, a lot of that was packaging up content and productizing my solutions. With generative AI, for example, I built a custom chatbot around one of my pieces of intellectual property on problem reframing. So clients would bring me in, we'd do some sessions, we'd do some problem reframing. Now I just say, here's a chatbot. It has all my content. Go do it. What are we going to do next together that the chatbot can't do that's going to bring even higher value to you?
Mm-hmm. And Gregory asked a question, which Stephen, maybe you can address, and let's go to Mara too. Like, are there other ways you're using generative AI in the consulting business? Like, we definitely have heard, you know, for folks who are filling out the 38-page RFP where you're not actually sure that people are going to read the answers on page 30 through 38, like, you know, can you use generative AI to fill in some of those answers? But any other ways you're using it, Stephen?
I use it a lot. For example, if I'm preparing for a speech, I use it to accelerate my ability to do some research for it. So what I'm trying to do is, if my clients, and it seems to be there's a demand to lower the fees in a number of different areas, well, in order for me to do that, but still deliver the same level of value, I have to get better at being able to deliver that value. So I use generative AI myself to be able to accelerate the way I do things. We're like, one of the things we're doing right now is we're translating one of my books into Chinese, and we're using AI to help do that. So there's just so many different ways that allows us to not get 100% solution. The translation from English to Chinese, from what we can tell, is about a 50% solution, but it still cuts the time in half. So we're able to do much more than we were able to do in the past. And when I can sort of give these tools to my clients and they can do it, here's the crazy thing is, it creates greater demand for my services rather than less demand. Because when they use these tools and they see what's possible, they also realize there's another level beyond. And I found it to be sometimes giving away my intellectual property to be one of my best sales tools.
Love it. So Mara, where's your head at? How is Ideate? I think you said Ideate is about a 15-person firm right around the US. Like, how are you guys using generative AI, or what pressures are you feeling?
Yeah, thanks so much, Scott. And thanks for putting this group together. This conversation has been so great and so top of mind, especially since the time we spent together in Sunnyvale at the AI Leveraging AI conference. So we've been using the AI internally for some kind of basic tasks to accelerate what we do. For example, for some of the other smaller consulting firms that are on this call, a lot of our SOWs that we'll create are really custom. You know, we're building them as we go for different clients based on their maturity, what they need. And so the SOW writing process can be like a half a day in terms of interpreting what they need and putting that into a structured deliverable form. We basically fed all of our language, all of our offerings, everything we could possibly do into a tool that one of our developers created for us. And it's building these scope of work documents that are so much better than what we were writing and really capture everything that we want to be able to deliver deliver for those clients. And that has taken what would be like a half day, maybe even a full day sometimes of like writing these charts and deliverables into an hour with a few edits. And that's been pretty incredible. And we're excited about that capability to turn things around a lot faster and keep the momentum going when there's interest in potentially bringing us on as a partner. We've also been using it to amplify our customer discovery work. So our synthesis process after, you know, we've been on, you know, hundreds of calls trying to understand pain points and opportunities in white space, we're able to feed all those findings into our machine and be able to help us identify all the trends, the gaps. And we're working on some tools to maybe do a little bit more sentiment analysis, but that has incredibly accelerated our ability to do those synthesizing workshops, which again would be like full day debriefs on what we had learned, and now it's being turned out in a couple of hours. So we're using it in our own business. It's exciting. It's also scary to see like how powerful and almost humbling to some degree, where as consultants, you think, you know, we're experts, we're really good at this, like what we do is special and unique and necessary. And then this technology comes in and kind of sits you down in the corner and makes you feel like maybe you're not as special as you thought. But so there's been some humbling experiences as we've started implementing more technology. But the silver lining and the positive to all that is it creates efficiencies to free us up to do really great strategic work to focus on different opportunities to build our business and create new offerings, but we're still figuring it out as we go. So calls like this are really powerful. I think we talked at the conference about these kind of conversations feeling like therapy sessions. That's how I feel right now. I feel like I should lay back and put my feet up as we talk more, but yeah, that's where we're at as a company. And I welcome any questions from anyone else in the group about how we've been building some of those tools.
Well, I was going to say, anyone else in the group that wants to join us on the screen and jump in with questions or comments, just raise your hand or put something in the chat. We'll bring you up. Mara, like when you do start thinking about the worry, the concern, like how does this firm grow in the future? Like, where does your head go?
Everywhere. It's such, I mean, we're so early in the business model, like envisioning of what the future of our organization looks like. But I think we're having weekly meetings and brainstorming on it. We're doing research as a group. We're having really active conversations. I don't know the answer to that, Scott. But I think the activity is just keeping it top of mind and making sure we're not just kind of sitting on our thumbs waiting for the market to change, but being intentional and proactive and plotting our course as it comes.
I'm curious if there are other thoughts on the screen about, you know, when you think about the growth of this industry and like, where does growth come from? I don't know, you know, Dan put forward a hypothesis that it really is going to be about these very dynamic, flexible networks of people, you know, versus the 10,000 people in 100 offices around the world. Abby, I'm curious if you have thoughts or others want to jump in on like, okay, this is clearly a transitional year, a transitional couple years with the arrival of AI, but like, what's your belief about, you know, the future models that work and where growth comes from?
So well, I think, just to clarify, are you talking about, because you were talking about the people and the networks? I mean,
for firms, right?
Growth, like, models is a very broad question.
Yeah. Sorry. For firms, I was thinking, where does growth, you know, where does growth come from going forward, and perhaps like where do you land on the model? You know, like, is there still a benefit of the like army of the smartest people in offices around the world, or does it really go to like a very federated, distributed model, as Dan was describing?
Well, I'll jump in. I do believe that there is something to having a team, a committed team of people that are engaged and employed by a company, because it takes work to learn how to work together and to get value from one another. So anyone who's been working at the cross-section of multidisciplinary design and innovation knows that it's not something that you get right off the bat. So teams need to learn to work together. And I, you know, I've certainly spent a lot of time talking to the new kind of global design networks of individual contributors who are now, you know, working together through, there's Neil and, you know, there's, I guess, three of them now about it. And it's an interesting idea. And it certainly got, I'm watching, you know, how those evolve to see where it goes and certainly paying attention and having dialogues with folks. But knowing, you know, how much work it takes to get people to really understand how to get value from disparate perspectives from each other is something that you need to have trust. You need to have a team, and that team can be globally distributed, but it has to be committed, I think, to be able to get the maximum value, because people get better and better at working with one another across various disciplines as they do it more and more. And when I find that I can get designers who are excited to talk to, you know, technologists from the Salesforce practice, I've won, right? Because that doesn't happen just by accident. And so I think, you know, you need to have some forcing functions that make people really deliver that value. And I think there's always going to be, you know, a market for that kind of exponential value.
Abby, it's so good to see you again. And I'm reminded of how smart you are. And I hope that this time I don't think you're smart because I agree with you, but I agree with you. And I think that these things like Neol, N-E-O-L, if you're not familiar with it, which is part of the Q Collective, which is part of IDEO, I think it's more a barometer of the times that we're in. Collectives show up when there are shifts in the market, when really smart people become free agents. And I think maybe there's something to it long-term, and I think there'll always be a place for this, but I think there are so many, and there's not just three. There are lots and lots of collectives that have shown up because people are looking at each other after they lost their job at Facebook and Google and go on and on and on and trying to figure out what's next. And I don't know how you sell the value of that collective. And I don't, to your point, I don't know how you get people to work together in teams. I think one advantage to a big company that a collective offers is that you can offload, you can shift that downtime problem that Dan talked about to the individual and away from the company. But yeah. I think the inverse of that is that you don't have teams that you can rely on. You don't, you know, Neil is building an AI front end to their, you know, find a person thing that could be interesting. But I think when you're hiring an advisor, you really want to see the whites of their eyes and understand what their, you know, what their contribution is, and can you work with them?
Yeah, 100%. Miss you too, John.
One other thing to touch on, which came up earlier in the thread, is kind of changes in how corporates should buy or are buying, advice that you may have there, or trends, dynamics that you may be seeing there in terms of, you know, that structure of projects, maybe the pace at which it operates. Mar, do you want to jump in first there and then others can follow you?
Yeah, thanks, Scott. So we have shifted our model. It doesn't work for every client, but I'll share with this group. We have shifted more from time and materials and project-based to more of a retained partner model, where we're embedded an embedded extension of the team. And it's really been a beautiful model for us on a few different levels. One, from a business perspective, a business model perspective as a consultant, we're not in a constant sales cycle. I'm not sure about the other smaller consulting or boutique consulting firms, but we don't have a dedicated BD person or salesperson. It's like all of us and mostly me. But I also work in the business and with our clients. And so being able to be an embedded resource has been great from a capacity standpoint. It doesn't work for every client, but especially the ones that we've had longer relationships with, most of them have been receptive to transferring from time and materials over to retained ongoing monthly installments for a guaranteed amount of time. Usually for us, it's a minimum of 6 months, but a lot of them are multi-year contracts, and that's been really great for us. Again, that's for just as advice to the group, that usually works best when you already have trust in an existing relationship. It's a kind of hard, high bar to sell if it's a new relationship, but that's been really helpful for us. And it's also nice to be able to have that level of depth and understanding and purview into all the different projects that the team is working on, so that you can advise across everything and see where there's gaps and where there's things you can do strategically to optimize the efficiencies of that team beyond the single project.
Other thoughts, Dan, you said you advise a number of consulting firms. Like, are you seeing similar things to what Mara described, different types of dynamics on the buyer side?
Yeah, 100%, right? You know, and you've got two sides to the business. You've got your supply side, which is the labor. Some of the trends that I brought up, the issues pushing back against those that Abby and John described, but you're always looking at that. Then the other thing you can do is how you bring in your pricing and revenue to, essentially help you deal with the fact that you have this cost model. And the challenges in the pricing and consulting are, I mean, there's always a margin issue, but there's also predictability is just an enormous issue, right? So predictability of revenue is huge for consulting firms. It's something that they want to achieve. And I think what Abby is describing is a way that adds value to the client that allows you to achieve that. You can't get to that kind of pricing unless there's a reason why the client would want that. But I see that kind of thing all that time. So a lot of what I'm doing with my clients is like basically breaking the business model apart and working on these individual pieces. It's not always as sexy as AI, right? But consulting firm is a hard type of business to run. It's a really difficult type of business to run. And if you can turn the knobs on these different pieces of it, it can help a lot, right?
For sure. Hey, Alex, I brought you back just because I feel like you've been talking to, you know, a lot of consulting firms where they're selling expertise in people's hours. You've also been talking to a lot of AI innovation platforms, you know, where it's like, hey, the AI tool is going to do front end of innovation insights work for you and kind of help you develop and test venture ideas. Like, give us one or two provocative thoughts before we wrap up here about do those two universes just continue to evolve alongside each other? Do you foresee some collisions, some friction? What are you seeing?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, Dan started off with absolutely the right question, which is how do we define consulting? What are we talking about? Because consulting, you know, can pretty much mean anything under the sun in terms of, you know, providing support, changing something. But, you know, it's everything from just sort of talk and analysis and advisory and sort of empathy and therapy, you know, to real deep implementation and creation. And, you know, keep coming back to that Harvard Business Review article back in September, written by some of our friends, Paul Baer, John Svokla, and others, which, you know, posits that words, images, numbers, sounds framework. So it essentially looks at generative AI and says, look, it's really good at analyzing, communicating, and creating things that are word-centric, image-centric, number-centric, and sound-centric. And so, you know, wherever there is consulting work that is centered on those things, generative AI is most easily able to do some of that. And so, you know, I think when we talk about strategy consulting, innovation consulting, where there's a lot of, again, analysis and codification and synthesis and, you know, discussion, generative AI has a lot of that in the crosshairs. And that's different potentially from, you know, building physical things, right? Or implementing, you know, IT systems. So, you know, I think, of course, with our community, the majority focus is on that strategy, innovation, growth work. And, you know, certainly with generative AI, those organizations that are digitally DNA'd and building digital things, right, there's a lot of companies out there using agents, creating platforms that will actually build those things on their own, right? So I think there's certain areas that are absolutely more exposed, you know, than others. And for everybody here, I mean, the more your work is, again, around words, images, numbers, sounds, you know, the thing that survives, it's the trusted human relationships. And you can use Gen AI to build expertise, show that you care, that you understand your client's space, and that really helps with all of it. But to the extent that you're doing a lot of stuff that's, you know, writing things and researching things and codifying and synthesizing things, you know, figuring out pretty quickly how to use Gen AI to make you better at that rather than replace you is really important. Last thing I'll say, you know, look, very few folks that we've talked to in the strategy and innovation consulting space are just dismissing Gen AI. Vast majority see it as an opportunity. Many see it as an existential threat. What's interesting is the larger the human consulting business of the existing consultancy, the more reticence naturally there is to kill that golden goose and just, you know, self-disrupt, whereas some that have a small human business are just moving fast to self-disrupt. But, you know, the human piece is crucial here because corporate leaders don't understand AI and they don't want to take AI recommendations right away, right? So you need the human. So there's just this very interesting discussion and evolution going on, which is, you know, what's that right mix between humans and technology in consulting going forward? And how long will that human piece be absolutely necessary until corporations are such consumers of, you know, AI-centric results that they say, ah, you know, if you've got humans, you're more expensive than you should be. So jury's out on a lot of that stuff, but of course, that's what we're looking at.
I wanted to just briefly share, and maybe Abby wants to do some color commentary on some of the predictions that folks shared here that got voted up towards the top. I'm seeing change management on the upswing as a consulting area. Marketing is going in the other direction. CMOs, entire marketing departments being laid off left and right. We touched on more productized offerings. Abby, someone agreeing with you, the requirement for consulting will lean on proof and creativity. Consulting will lean on differentiation, trust building, creativity, and talent augmentation. Any thoughts of it other than that third person is very smart?
Yeah, they're just so clever. You know, I think the marketing prediction was an interesting one to me, because I'm seeing marketing departments are being laid off, but they're being rebuilt. I mean, they're not going away. And I'm seeing that there's a tremendous demand right now. The CMO, the role of CMO is completely being reshaped. So that division that you used to see between upstream and downstream, above the line, below the line, and, you know, the whole, like, the campaign versus the actual innovation is being conflated. And so CMOs are reinventing themselves, and marketing departments are needing to really reshape what their role is in the enterprise. So I think that's a really interesting area for disruption, because it puts marketing more in the business of the substance of the business. I think that's interesting.
I like the point, just because I'm a fan of human beings. Curtis says, God help us if AI makes human conversations like this one today unnecessary. Quality dialogue and quality facilitation eternally needed. I hope so, Curtis. This has been a really fantastic conversation. We are still in the experimental mode of when you send transcripts of conversations like this, insightful, brilliant people thinking about what's changing, where we're going. Can AI do a good job of synthesizing it? We think it does like a B+ job in general. So we'll share a synthesis on the website. But for today, I'll just say we have another one of these member meetings coming up next week with Gene O'Connor from Babson, Nazir Bore from ExxonMobil, talking about building strategic innovation capability that's going to last. They talk about the three presidents test. Can you last through three presidents of your company without it getting cut, going away, being rebuilt? So that's happening next Thursday. I want to thank Stephen, Mara, Alex, Abby, Dan, John for helping really keep this conversation moving. It was a fantastic way to end the week. And it's always great to see so many of you in two dimensions, as much as we love seeing you in three dimensions. Roger, Lisa, it was great having you as part of this conversation. And hope we'll see you next week or at a future In Elite event. Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much, Scott.
Thanks, Alex.
Thanks very much, Scott.
Bye, everyone. Have a lovely weekend.
See you guys.